Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is Jupiter from Gustav Holst's seven-movement work, The Planets. This is one of many great works that were inspired by the heavens. But more than the universe just being a muse for some of the great masterpieces of music history, there is an even more inspiring connection between the universe and music, and between the mathematical construct of the cosmos and harmony. In this episode, we will explore these inspiring connections between the universe, mathematics, and music. In our segment, Sounds of Scripture, we will see biblical evidence of this concept. In Classroom Corner, we will talk about the role math plays in music education, and via Skype, I interview a professor of mathematics, Dr. David Kung, about a fascinating course that he taught on how mathematics and music relate.
At every stage of the musical experience, there's mathematics hiding there.
And in our segment, Backstage Banter, we have a riveting discussion with the piano technician who preps the Steinways for all the major artists who come through the Oklahoma area, Peter Krause.
If I move this note a couple of hundredths of a cent, suddenly that interval sings. It's like a human voice. It changes into something transcendent. It makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck when I find it. At that point, the piano technician becomes a co-performer.
Today on Music for Life, the harmony of the heavens. My father, Wilbur Malone, served as a minister for the Philadelphia Church of God, the church that sponsors this radio station, and he was known for giving sermons that always touched on the grandeur of the universe.
Some of you know I'm kind of a universe buff, and I keep a folder on it, and sometimes you kind people, knowing I'm that way, and you see something on the universe you think I might like, you mail it to me, and I thank you for that, okay? Astronomers estimate that our galaxy, the Milky Way, contains between 100 and 200 billion stars. But if you could actually count the stars at 125 stars a minute, that'd be pretty good counting. It would take you 2,000 years to count the stars in our galaxy. Some galaxies contain as many as 10 trillion stars.
After his death in 2004, I received many questions asking if I'd continue his legacy of discussing the universe in my various speaking opportunities. It wasn't long after that I started studying more deeply into this idea of the harmony of the spheres, an endeavor that really combines both our mutual fascinations with the universe and music. This idea, the harmony of the spheres, or the music of the spheres, as it's sometimes called, is the idea that the planets were analogous to musical pitches, first in the sense that their distances held the same ratios as between musical intervals that we found most pleasing. And second, literally, in that, quote, the planets, or rather the spheres, resounded in actual, though imperceptible, tones, unquote. And that's what Kurt Zox wrote in Rise of Music in the Ancient World. This concept of the harmony of the spheres, as we'll see, has been referenced throughout history and even in popular culture today. Back in the summer of 2008, a concert at London's Royal Albert Hall featured a seven-minute video starring the latest incarnation of the fictional character Doctor Who. This concert featured music from the Doctor Who television series, and in this video, titled Music of the Spheres, he tells us,
well, you got all those planets revolving around suns, and all those suns revolving around in a galaxy. and all those galaxies revolving around each other. If you take the gravity patterns, feed them through the TARDIS harmonic filter, that, Mr. Grask, is the sound of the universe.
This concept's origin is attributed by many to Pythagoras. Now, I can show you that it was around before him, but there is a wealth of information written surrounding Pythagoras and this subject. Aristotle said that to the Pythagoreans, the whole heaven was a musical scale and a number. That's what Jamie James writes in his book, The Music of the Spheres. James continues, here in our first encounter with the concept of the musical universe, it is clear that the Pythagoreans did not simply discern congruities among number and music and the cosmos, they identified them. Music was number, and the cosmos was music. The Pythagoreans conceived of the cosmos as a vast lyre, with crystal spheres in the place of strings. Jamie James writes that Plato believed that the celestial logic, once it was understood, would be reconcilable with a sublime system of mathematical harmony. Also, according to Plato, he writes, music and mathematics could be used to explain every terrestrial phenomenon. They encompassed every possible dimension of thought. Pythagoras was a lyre player intrigued by whole numbers. He believed that pure music is number made audible. That's what Jamie James writes. Pure music is number made audible. An article published in December 2005 for astronomy.com says Pythagoras, quote, found that a plucked string produces its most pleasing tones when divided into whole number ratios. For example, a string held at its middle produced sound pitched exactly one octave higher than the whole string. This ratio between the two pitches is an example of 2-1, since half the string vibrates twice as fast as the whole string. If two notes an octave apart sound together, then for every two waves of the higher frequency, there is one wave of the lower frequency. This alignment of both pitches every other wave means the two notes sound pleasing together, that is, in harmony or consonant harmony. Continuing on with a quote from Jamie James, the hidden order in sound. The hidden order in sound reinforced his own sense of an underlying cosmic harmony expressed in number and proportion. His followers extended this idea, assuming that the crystalline spheres thought to carry the sun, moon, and planets were spaced according to musical intervals. Later, Plato imagined each sphere producing a single tone, and the music of the spheres was born. Now, according to the Bible's mention of the music of the spheres, it is unlikely that it was born at the time of Pythagoras or Plato. So let's move into our first segment of the show today, Sounds of Scripture, to see how this relates to the musical references found in the Bible.
The sky's like a heavenly harp, the spheres like harmonious strings, resound with the glory of God. His wisdom and brilliance they sing.
That's a poetic rendition of the first several verses of Psalm 19, performed in our original stage production here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. David, the Endless Throne begins. There, the title character, as a young shepherd, sings these words. The skies, like a heavenly harp, the spheres, like harmonious strings, resound with the glory of God, His wisdom and brilliance they sing. Here's what Psalm 19 says in the King James Version of the Bible. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night shows knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them has He set a tabernacle for the sun. This psalm was also used in the most well-known chorus from Franz Joseph Haydn's oratorio, The Creation. This is, "The Heavens Are Telling."
Thank you.
This is being performed in German, the language that Haydn originally wrote this oratorio in, and it is a rendition of Psalm 19. The translation into English of this particular text says, "The heavens are telling the glory of God, the wonder of his works displays the firmament. Today that is coming speaks it the day, the night that is gone to following night. In all the land resounds the word, never unperceived, ever understood." And the chorus keeps singing, "The heavens are telling the glory of God, the wonder of his works displays the firmament." That was "The Heavens Are Telling" from Franz Joseph Haydn's oratorio, The Creation, performed by the Krakow National Philharmonic Orchestra and Chorus. We are in our segment, Sounds of Scripture, and we're talking about biblical references to this concept of the harmony of the spheres. Psalm 19, which is what that Haydn chorus was based on, says, "The heavens declare the glory of God." And then verse 4 of that psalm says, "Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." The word for line there can mean rope or musical string. When the Jewish-schooled Apostle Paul quoted this verse to the Romans, he used a Greek word for line that actually translates into musical sound. Romans 10:18 reads, "Their sound went into all the earth, and their words unto the end of the world." According to Strong's Concordance, the Greek word here for sound means musical sound, whether vocal or instrumental, and is only used in one other place in the New Testament. It's used here, and it's used in 1 Corinthians 14:7, which speaks of the distinction in the sounds of the pipe and the harp. So it is a musical term. These verses do not contain merely poetic or symbolic language about the cosmos. They undoubtedly reference this concept known as the harmony of the spheres. The Bible's mention of the harmony of the spheres concept shows that this theory would not have originated with the Greeks. Alfred Sendri, in his book Music in Ancient Israel, writes this: Pythagoras seems to have been largely instrumental in the introduction of that theory, since it is a well-known fact that he had had strong leanings toward borrowing his ideas from Oriental sources or from more Eastern sources. Pythagoras of Samos is attributed to living between 560 and 480 BC, and this is near the time when Judah was taken captive by the Babylonians, and it says in the Bible that the Babylonians gleaned much from the educational and musical systems of the Jews. Psalm 137 verses 1 to 4 show that, and Daniel 1 verse 4 shows that as well. Now, this is interesting since some historians clearly attribute the harmony of the spheres not to the Greeks but to the Hebrews. Alfred Sendri writes, expressions like when the morning stars sang together and sing, O heavens, Isaiah 49:13, reflect the teaching of the ancient Orient about the harmony of the spheres. According to it, the seven planets produce the seven tones of the basic musical scale as discovered independently and expounded by ancient theorists. That's a quote from Alfred Sendri's book, Music in Ancient Israel. Even in the New Testament, which was written in the Greek language, the Greek word used to describe one of Jesus Christ's names is logos. And this is the Greek word used for the Word, as in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, as John 1 talks about. This is the member of the God family who created all things, according to that passage in John 1, as well as a passage in Ephesians 3. This Greek word logos is the same Greek word for the English word ratio. It's as if the biblical text is telling us how Jesus Christ was the revelatory thought, spokesman, and mathematical executioner of the God realm. The Bible reveals that God measures and calculates elements of his creation. You can see that in Isaiah 40, verse 12, that he is the master mathematician who created the celestial orchestra that we call the universe. Therefore, it is not strange that Israel, a nation that God worked directly with, according to the scriptures, was aware of these heavenly and mathematical phenomena, as well as the similarities between earthly music and the cosmic structure. Sendri asserts this: the early translators of the Bible assumed the poets of the Old Testament to have been familiar with the harmony of the spheres. Thus, the verse in Song of Songs 6:10, clear as the sun, is translated by Aquila as sounding as the sun. The Vulgate renders Job 38:37, who will reduce to silence the music of heaven? That word for music, oddly translated bottles in the King James Version, who will silence the bottles of heaven? That word there is nebel, which is used mostly in the Bible to describe a common musical instrument of the Hebrew culture. Who will silence these instruments of heaven? The Hebrews did not consider the heavens just as a metaphor to music. Talmudic writers, Sendri says, Talmudic writers adopted the biblical conception that the movement of celestial bodies produces certain sounds. They believed the heavens were actually making noise. Aristotle, in On the Heavens, confirmed his belief in this component as well. He wrote, the motion of bodies of that size must produce a noise, since on our earth the motion of bodies far inferior in size and speed of movement has that effect. Also, when the sun and the moon, they say, and all the stars so great in number and in size are moving with so rapid motion, how should they not produce a sound immensely great? starting from this argument and the observation that their speeds, as measured by their distances, are in the same ratios as musical concordances, they assert that the sound given forth by the circular movement of the stars is a harmony. Now again, the Hebrews didn't simply believe the space between them was akin to musical intervals, like mere poetic analogy, but that the celestial bodies were actually resounding in imperceptible tones. And it is amazing that the Hebrews knew this, because modern science is backing this up lately. This is that December 2005 Astronomy.com article that I quoted earlier. It says, sound exists anywhere pressure waves can travel. Any planet with an atmosphere provides audio opportunities. Sound waves not only course through the atmospheres of Mars, Venus, and Titan, but they also echo inside our sun and ripple through the gas surrounding an accreting or enlarging black hole. Other cosmic sounds occur when electronically charged gases, such as those in solar flares and aurora, interact with a planet's magnetic field. The result? Radio waves scientists can translate into sounds we can hear. Now, this article asserts that there are the equivalent of rhythmic pulses in the universe, like a percussion section, as well as low drones, like a bass section. An April 17, 2007 article on space.com shows how science has also discovered heavenly music bellowed out by the sun's atmosphere. These frequencies at a thousandth of a hertz, that's too low for human ears to hear since we can only hear between 20 to 20,000 hertz, a thousandth of a hertz. The study, it says, reveals that the looping magnetic fields along the sun's outer regions, called the corona, carry magnetic sound waves in a similar manner to musical instruments such as guitars or pipe organs. They found that explosive events at the sun's surface appear to trigger acoustic waves that bounce back and forth between both ends of the loops, a phenomenon known as a standing wave. These magnetic loops are analogous to a simple guitar string. If you pluck a guitar string, you will hear music. These energies are plucking these magnetic strings or standing pipes, which set up standing waves, exactly the same waves you see on a guitar string. By flying through space, celestial bodies are emitting sound. Deeper study of the heavens indicates that those sounds are working together, much like a musical composition. This has been Sounds of Scripture.
What is man that he is on your mind? What is man when all this you've designed? What is man that the work of your hand could be under his command? Your purpose is so grand. Will we ever understand? What is man?
You are listening to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and this is KPCG. Today we are discussing the harmony of the heavens. The typical format of the show is to give an overview of music history and the standard repertoire as relates to the episode's main theme. Today's program is discussing the idea of the harmony of the spheres. So we are going to explore compositions of music history that were inspired by or based on these mathematical connections between music and the cosmos, or at the very least were simply intended to describe the heavens or for which the universe was an inspiration. Many of history's great writers and composers believed in this mathematical connection between the universe and music, that music was somehow connected with the cosmos and even the eternal. The idea of the harmony of the spheres appears in Scipio's Dream, a fable written by Cicero back in the 2nd century AD, which later was turned into the basis for an opera-type piece that Mozart composed, a 15-year-old Mozart wrote. The text of that short one-act drama that Mozart wrote the music for references the harmony of the moving spheres you hear and uses this phrase, "Each gives forth a different sound from the next, and from all a harmonious sound is formed." Here's a segment of an aria where the character is answering Scipio's question, "Why does the glorious harmony not reach us?" She replies that it too far exceeds the perception of our senses. Here is this beautiful Mozart aria performed by Claudia Pataca. This is the work of a 15-year-old Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the operatic-type work Il Sogno di Scipione, or The Dream of Scipio, which is based on a 2nd-century text by Cicero. This text discusses this harmony of the spheres concept. It mentions a concord of tones separated by unequal but nevertheless carefully proportioned intervals caused by the rapid motion of the spheres themselves. Cicero's text refers to this concept, particularly the number 7, as the key to the universe or the bond of almost everything, quite literally translated. This is soprano Anna Fraser and the Australian early music ensemble Consort Astrea performing a piece by the late Renaissance composer Emilio de Cavalieri. This is from a vocal work that precedes Mozart, obviously. It would be considered a precursor to opera. This particular piece is about the harmony of the spheres and contains the phrase, "the sweet sound of celestial harmony." This composer would have been a contemporary of William Shakespeare's. Shakespeare himself references this concept of the harmony of the spheres in his works. In The Merchant of Venice, it references the orbs of heaven, their sweet harmony, and their motion like an angel sings, he says. Shakespeare and other prominent men of the Renaissance acknowledge this harmony of the spheres idea, and though it may have been connected by some to certain mythology and astrology, there's a mathematical component that is irrefutable, and that's what I want to focus on here today, these mathematical connections between music and the cosmos. Another Renaissance man worth mentioning is Vincenzo Galilei, an Italian composer and father of the famous astronomer Galileo Galilei. Vincenzo Galilei wrote extensively on the connections between mathematics, astronomy, and music. Then there was the late Renaissance mathematician and astronomer Johannes Kepler, who wrote The Harmony of the Universe, which another author called A Mathematician's Song of Songs. In it, he asserted that the movements of the heavens are nothing except a certain everlasting polyphony, that musical term meaning more than one melody going on at the same time, perceived by the intellect, not by the ear. Kepler wrote that God has represented himself in the world, and he was doing so through mathematics, he believed. I sometimes wonder, he writes, whether the whole of nature and all the beauty of the heavens is not symbolized in geometry. And he was trying to prove the relationship between the musical ratios and the motions of the planets by using geometric shapes. And he was finding these ratios that correlated between these perfect polygons and musical ratios. He was comparing these ratios of the planets as they related to the sun. And Jamie James explains this in his book, Music of the Spheres. Here's a quote. Saturn traverses an arc of 135 seconds per day when it is nearest the sun, if viewed from the sun. On the day it is farthest from the sun, the planet would appear to a solar observer to travel an arc of 106 seconds. The ratio of 135 to 106 is just a tiny fraction off of 5 to 4. 5 to 4 is the frequency ratio between two notes that sound a major third. And that is a pleasing sound to our ears, as we would call it. Using this method, he writes, he found to his delight that all six planets produced ratios almost precisely equivalent to harmonies that were expressible by perfect polygons. Jupiter's perihelial-aphelial ratio was more or less 6 to 5, a minor third. That of Mars, 3 to 2, a fifth. That of Earth, 16 to 15, a semitone or a half step. That of Venus, 24 to 25, barely equivalent to the Pythagorean comma, and that's a very technical and mathematical musical measurement, which we won't get into. And that of Mercury, 12 to 5, an octave and a minor third. So he was finding these ratios in the arc of the planets when closest to the sun and farthest away from the sun. And then Jamie James writes, Kepler points out that the changes in tone would not be divided into steps as required by staff notation, but would rather be an eternal note that rises and falls continuously, like a trombone player forever moving his valve back and forth, or a violinist pushing his finger up and down a string. In the case of the Earth, it is more like a vibrato because the entire range of the scale amounts to scarcely more than a semitone or a half step. That of Venus is even smaller, spanning an interval of 25 to 24. Finally, Kepler sets out to construct a celestial motet, a chord to unite the songs of all the planets. Thus, it is no idle figure of speech when he states that the movements of the heavens are nothing except a certain everlasting polyphony. In the 20th century, a composer by the name of Paul Hindemith wrote an opera on the life of Kepler called Die Harmonie der Welt, a Germanic rendition of Kepler's title. Jamie James writes that Hindemith had an explicitly astronomical view of harmony. The final chorus of the opera references the rich and gentle harmonies of the infinite cosmos. And at the premiere of the opera, Hindemith told Newsweek, "Time will tell whether my telescope was focused properly." Here's the end of that final chorus from the opera Die Harmonie der Welt, based on Johannes Kepler's work. Marek Janowski conducted the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra in that recording of Paul Hindemith's opera Die Harmonie der Welt, or The Harmony of the Universe, based on the work of the late Renaissance mathematician Johannes Kepler. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today's show is titled The Harmony of the Heavens. We are exploring in this episode these inspiring connections between the universe, mathematics, and music. We've shown how this concept of the harmony of the spheres, this idea that connects the cosmos with musical harmony, dates all the way back to the biblical record, and that it also pervades the study of astronomy throughout history. And we were just talking about the work of Johannes Kepler in the late Renaissance. This thinking was still prevalent in what we would call the Baroque era of music history. The Baroque era's most famous mathematician was Isaac Newton, who firmly believed, according to Jamie James' book, Music of the Spheres, that, quote, God revealed the eternal truths of the cosmos to a chosen handful of sages at the dawn of civilization, and that this knowledge was subsequently obscured and lost. Thus, his own mathematical work, he believed, was essentially that of a modern theologian rediscovering the wisdom of the ancients, unquote. That's what Newton believed, according to James's book. Newton wrote about the connection between the ratio of the celestial spheres and musical instruments, using the phrase the harmony of the heavens, which is where we got the title for this particular episode. According to James's book, Newton was the first to use logarithms in musical calculations. He also asserted an analogous relationship between the seven constituent colors of the spectrum of white light and the tones of the just musical scale. Here are the words of Newton himself. The soul of the world, which propels into movement this body of the universe visible to us, being constructed of ratios which created from themselves a musical concord, must of necessity produce musical sounds from the movement which it provides by its proper impulse, having found the origin of them in the craftsmanship of its own composition. Also in the Baroque era, the English poet John Milton wrote, And the low world in measured motion draw after the heavenly tune which none can hear of human mold with gross unpurged ear. And yet such music worthiest were to blaze the peerless height of her immortal praise. When it comes to Baroque music, Jamie James writes, By the time we reach the Baroque era, the connections between mathematics and musical composition are so well established that we must take care not to miss the trees for the forest. The composer of the day who embodied this was Johann Sebastian Bach, whose works are audible evidence of the inspiring connections between the mathematical, the musical, and the heavenly. Jamie James writes, The twin qualities in Bach's composition of numerical perfection and profound spirituality are remarked upon in almost every one of the hundreds of books about his works. In 1977, when the Voyager 1 space probe was launched into outer space, we put musical representations of Earth on the spacecraft in case it encountered any alien life forms. What's interesting about those musical representations, though, is that in addition to showcasing music from all over the world in so many different cultures, three of the pieces are by Johann Sebastian Bach, more than any other composer or style represented. It's almost globally accepted just from that, that Bach's music is considered one of the greatest achievements of humanity. Much, if not all, of his music was intended to glorify God, he said, to use music in an attempt to connect man with the spiritual. And that's not just a reference to his sacred music, which employs religious lyrics. Even the musical elements themselves, their perfect harmonies, represent that harmonic beauty evident in the construct of the physical universe, intending to make us more aware of its creator. In his choral masterpiece, St. Matthew's Passion, some would argue that not just the sacred textual content of the music, but the music itself and its blending of various pitches are intended to represent something divine. Here is one of the most famous arias from this epic work, Erbarme dich, mein Gott. It recalls the account of Peter weeping bitterly after denying Jesus three times. An English translation of this German text reads, "Have mercy, my God, for my tears' sake. Look hither, heart and eyes weep before thee bitterly." Here it is, sung by Christa Ludwig, accompanied by the Philharmonia Orchestra, Otto Klemperer conducting.
Thank you.
Oh, that's beautiful music. Music for life. This is Music for Life, and I'm your host, Ryan Malone. That was Christa Ludwig singing Erbarme dich mein Gott from Matthew's Passion by Johann Sebastian Bach. Today we're talking about the inspiring connections between the universe's composition and that of musical composition. Bach's works, like what we just heard, some would consider an acknowledgement of the cosmic element in the music itself, not just the sacred element in the lyrics, but in the way the tones are organized. That means you would even find this cosmic element in Bach's instrumental music, which certainly can be argued convincingly. This whole subject of the connections between cosmic harmony and musical harmony is intrinsically tied into the subject of tuning. We talk about something sounding in tune or out of tune. And that has to do with these mathematical ratios that exist in both the heavenly and musical construct. Tuning is a numeric or mathematical concept. It's these numeric concepts that are found in both our solar system and also in our greatest music. Instrument makers, composers, and music theorists have been faced with certain numeric challenges, math problems, if you will, about how to keep harmony stable and pleasing. I'll try to explain this simply. When two notes sound together, there is quite a complexity to whether or not they will sound pleasing. This is because when you hear a note, you're not just hearing one pitch. Each note has a set of overtones associated with it, other frequencies that are sounding at the same time. But our ears only perceive one pitch. But it's the combination of these other inaudible frequencies that tell us things like what kind of instrument is making that pitch, or the timbre of the pitch, that is. So when two notes sound, whether they are in tune or not has a lot to do with how not only the fundamental perceived pitches are blending with each other, but the lining up or the clashing of these overtones. All these mathematical elements have factored into how instruments have been created and tuned. This also has impacted the music that has been composed for these instruments. A perfect example of this is a set of keyboard pieces that Johann Sebastian Bach wrote. This group of keyboard pieces is from a volume called The Well-Tempered Clavier, clavier referring to a keyboard instrument, any keyboard instrument, and well-tempered referring to how that instrument is tuned in a way that allows it to play in every major or minor key without sounding out of tune in any of those keys. And this was a mathematical and scientific feat of tuning to allow an instrument that had this kind of range to play in all the major and minor keys. And with the 12 half steps of the octave, there are 24 major and minor keys, a major and minor key for each half step. Bach writes a prelude and fugue for each tonality. He writes a prelude and fugue in C, a prelude and fugue in C minor, a prelude and fugue in C sharp, a prelude and fugue in C sharp minor, and so on. He liked this so much, actually, that he wrote another set of preludes and fugues. That's called The Well-Tempered Clavier, Volume 2, or Book 2. This is a prelude and fugue from Book 1 in D major. The prelude is basically an improvisatory-sounding short piece. It has a perpetual motion in the right hand and a staccato punctuation on each beat in the left hand. Thank you. the second movement is a fugue movement, which we've talked about before is like a complex round. Pianist Andreas Schiff performed Bach's Prelude and Fugue in D major from the Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 1. This is an example of how the math and science of tuning impacted the way instruments were made and therefore the way composers composed for those instruments. We'll talk more about these connections when we come back and sit down in backstage banter with a piano technician who is known for his great work throughout the Midwest region. We'll also discuss the role math plays in music education, and I'll introduce you to perhaps the most famous work in music history that's inspired by outer space. This is Music for Life, and we'll be right back.